really got to want to do it. You've just got to be quite single-minded about that and soldier on and laugh it off. And if you haven't got a sense of humor, then you are dog meat in this. You're so far away from me. You're so far away from me. Whereas one of the things about MTV that struck me was that it was influencing children seriously. That 9-year-olds were into this.
Big time.
I saw a little boy in my head, and like a Peter Pan or a graphic, and you're flying across the landscape and you're zooming through it and right up into his window. It's a bit like something, Steven Spielberg would do. That's how I saw it. In a TV light.
I'm working.
Hello, this is Mark Knopfler of Dire Straits in the studio for Brothers in Arms.
By May 1985, Mark Knopfler, the songwriter, singer, and innovative guitar player of British band Dire Straits, was a veteran band leader with a loyal international following. Dire Straits had released 4 critically acclaimed studio albums, plus a live album, and consistently could fill 5,000 seaters in Europe and North America, too. When Brothers in Arms, the 5th Dire Straits studio album, was released in May 1985, Mark Knopfler thought he'd already seen the celebrity fame game up close and personal. When the 1st Dire Straits album became an international hit in the fall of 1978 because it contained the unlikely single Sultans of Swing, here's Mark Knopfler with me in the studio.
When it was tough was about after the first record went crazy all over the world, but I was 28, so... if I'd been 18, I'd probably be dead by now. I mean, I think that helps, that to be that little bit older helps you survive it. But even then, but the second album time, I went through a rough period, definitely adjusting to being, for want of a better word, famous. In fact, the vast majority of people down at the, in the hardware store don't know you and don't care about rock and roll, and why you're too busy running the hardware store. But there was a lot of attention, and it can make you slightly nuts. And I think I went a little bit nuts for a while about second album time, that famous second album time when everybody gets pushed into their second album and so on and so forth, and people start making sort of judgments and expectation and all the rest of it. And you're working very hard, you're touring, and it wasn't a good period, just for a little while, but I adjusted to it and then just said, okay, well, I'm going on. There was the usual fallout and a bit of blood on the carpet and a few smashes and scalps and stuff. And then, but then generally, you clean up and you say, okay, I'm going on, and I'll go on. And I just sort of plowed on into the other records and just worked my way out of it and worked my way through it and got used to it all. But the casualty, if that's what you're referring to, the casualty rate has always been a part of it. Marriages and relationships and radiators blowing up when you're 2,000 miles away. And, that sort of thing. I mean, and your mother saying, well, it would be nice if you called a bit more. And all those sort of things that go with it. And people's preconceptions, misconceptions about you, and then all the rubbish that gets written as well. You just have to come to terms with it.
Here I am again in this mean old town, and you're so far away from me. And where are you when the sun goes down? You're so far away from me. You're so far away from me. You're so far. I just can't see. You're so far away from me. You're so far away from me. All right. I'm tired of being in love and being all alone. When you're so far away from me. Far away from me. You're so
so far away from me. You're so far, I just can't see. You're so far away from me. You're so far away from me. All right. And I get so tired when I have to explain, and you're so far away. So far, I just can't see. You're so far away from me. You're so far away from me.
Take it out.
May 1985's Brothers in Arms album from Dire Straits contained the song So Far Away. As anyone who has ever written a letter to the editor now realizes, the editor always gets the last word, and Mark Knopfler agrees.
If you're a writer, you can make stuff up and take liberties, and you can come out being the good guy. I remember I wrote a song called So Far Away, and I said, "You've been in the sun and I've been in the rain." And of course, I remember... my wife said to me, that, "What do you mean? You know, you've been in the sun and I've been in the rain." So I'm not sure. So it's a double-edged thing. I mean, writers take liberties and make things up. They're not necessarily. I mean, a funny thing about songs. A lot of people assume that just because you've written a song, it's written from your heart. It's actually not. I mean, for me, a lot of stuff is invented and comes from all kinds of different reasons. And you fictionalize and you borrow and you. You might use a little bit of yourself, and it might be about somebody else. It's really, it can, or the song might work on a bunch of levels. So you protect yourself to a certain extent, or you invent characters and so on and so forth. A lot of people seem to, they're perfectly fine about it with an author, but they're not quite, a lot of people aren't quite so used to that with a song. They seem to assume that a song is just going to be the feelings of the guy or the girl who's singing it, and that's not altogether always true.
Dire Straits' Brothers in Arms album has several indications as to the time and place that it was made, from reggae inspirations to the Contra Wars in Central America in the mid-80s.
The Police did a song called One World Not Three,
I was discussing with Sting the origin of the term third world. Do you have any idea who coined that or when it was first used?
It's maybe something that came up in the United Nations.
That's what he said. That's what Sting said.
I just think it's to do with, it's something, one world, the idea of one world is more and more apparent, is more and more insistent as time's gone on with communications, and we hop around in it as though it's our garden a lot of the time. We're in continual contact across it, around it, and we're always conscious of the fact that it is one and that it's fragile and all the rest of it.
When you say we, though, who are you speaking to?
Us, all of us. More and more of us are aware of the fact that there is one world. It's just one world. Although it's absolutely obvious, of course, that it is obvious that the one world does not exist in our heads. My world is, and your world do have a lot of similarities, but not to an Afghani tribesman. His world is completely different. His religion is different. His ideas about everything are different.
Everything.
His just
culture.
About everything.
Yeah.
Band Dire Straits, featuring John Ilsley on bass, Omar Hakim on drums, Guy Fletcher on keyboards, and Mark Knopfler on guitar and vocal, doing One World from the May 1985 release of Brothers in Arms. Next, how the sound of Let's Dance and Palisades Park helped to inspire one of the biggest hits from this album. I'm Redbeard. You're in the studio with Mark Knopfler for the 10th anniversary of the worldwide 30 million seller, double Grammy winner, Brothers in Arms from Dire Straits.
Hello, this is Mark Knopfler of Dire Straits in the studio for Brothers in Arms.
And I'm Red Beard for this landmark album. Mark Knopfler agrees that for the Cajun meets rockabilly chug of the hit song Walk of Life, that the reedy keyboard part would actually and authentically be played on an accordion. But Mark Knopfler also admits that the organ sound on Walk of Life is pure rock candy.
I've always loved old records that did that, like organ sound on Less Dance or something, Chris Montez.
That's a wonderful song.
Terrific, isn't it?
Yes, it is.
The organ's always been really important to me, that from Runaway, Del Shannon, that made a big impression on me, I think, that record. And when you, and it, I also liked it in Palisades Park by Freddie Cannon. And then growing up in Newcastle is where the Animals came from, and I always felt that they had, with the Vox organ on House of the Rising Sun and stuff like that, that it made a difference too. With all of this work that's gone on synthesizers and synclaviers and this, that and the other, they can't sample it so that, and you can't get the flexibility and the movement out of a program, a Hammond program in a synth that'll do it, because it's swooping and changing and going on to Leslie's and everything all so much that it's an impossible thing. It's like a saxophone. You can't do it on a synth.
A number two hit in the UK, number seven in the States, was Walk of Life from Dire Straits' May 1985 album Brothers in Arms.
And another thing I like about it is just talking about Walk of Life or Lake's Trick is where there's an instrumental figure, and I don't know where those things come from. Where, I suppose it's from listening to a lot of reggae records. I was listening a lot to Iger Man and different people like that at the time. But it was actually before that I wrote it. So I don't know where it comes from. There was a lot of reggae being played in London for a lot of years, even more than there is now. There's a record that made a big impression on me was the soundtrack to Harder They Come. There's some beautiful things on it. And the original, The Rivers of Babylon by the Melodians, and Stop That Train, I Want to Get Off. All of that sort of stuff. Beautiful, beautiful things. I mean, if you listen to Bob Marley's band playing, you turn it up, there's a great feeling of relaxed togetherness on the thing. Everybody's just in the groove.
Locked in.
Playing great.
Almost as one.
Yeah. And it's
almost got to be genetic, or certainly growing up and living, you know, shoulder to shoulder in a certain existence, don't you think? I mean, it's more than notes, right?
Yeah, it's sort of a belief.
30 years ago, Dire Straits embarked on what grew into a 250-concert world tour, which extended deep into 1986. They did 10 nights at London's Wembley Arena, then strolled across the parking lot to the massive Wembley Stadium on July 16, 1985 for Live Aid, seen by an estimated 1.5 billion viewers. But listen carefully to what Mark Knopfler says about massive fame and massive popularity. It almost sounds as if he could just as easily be describing failure.
If you've really got to want to do it, I mean, you can't get upset. I've seen people when they've read the first interviews, nonsense, you get used to all this stuff, you know, lies and just pure nonsense. I mean, there's no the libel laws. The laws about all that. You don't have to tell the truth as long as it's not libelous. It doesn't have to be true. And so you just have to get used to it. You've really got to want to do it. You've just got to be quite single-minded about that and soldier on and laugh it off. And if you haven't got a sense of humor, then you are dog meat in this. The way that I like to approach it is a lot of invective, a lot of abuse, a lot of swear words, and a lot of jokes. And that's one of the things I like about Nashville, too, is that easygoing approach to it and not taking it too seriously. I think if you let things get to you, you know, if you take yourself too seriously, or take the work all too seriously, I'm talking about an approach. I mean, obviously, you're serious about it. You're serious about music. But having said that, that's a given. That's something that everybody understands. But then having they understand that, then you just get on and just take the rise out of each other all the time, or insult each other, and just that's a good way of doing it, and be horrible to people is just a way of having fun. And if you haven't got a sense of humor in a band, I think that's you'd be missing the most important thing to survive. As well as the willpower. You need a lot of willpower. You've really got to want to do it. Because if you're in the middle of it and you're getting on with it and you enjoy it, you're in the middle of it. You don't see it the way people do on the outside. You're a working man and you're just getting on with it. That's how it is. You don't view it. You can't see it that way. And just because something is massively commercially successful, it doesn't stop you being, you know, that's no reflection on the quality of what it is. I mean, it can still be average stuff and do well. I mean, everything demonstrates that. I mean, I'm sure that a lot of the top movies that people are going to see wouldn't, in my book, you know, they wouldn't be movies that I would necessarily want to go into. I mean, a lot of the time I find myself out of step with what people say is popular. You know, the record becomes popular. I mean, I think an album becomes popular simply because you get a bunch of hit singles away. And so you sell a lot of albums because people want to get all those songs on that particular thing, and there they all are. They're all in there. So that has a big bearing on it. Then again, you know, it was the 80s, and I think it was a boom time. And who knows? That can't affect you. It can't you can't let things like that sidetrack you. You know? You can't be sidetracked by anything particularly. You mustn't let people interfere with your happiness, whoever you are, whatever you. You can't let people I mean, obviously, you've got to feel, you've got to be human, you've got to feel, and you've got to feel disappointment the same as other people do and everything else, and you've got to feel the joy of that. You can't say, I have no feelings, you know, you have to find them for yourself and everything else. But writing is, in itself, a kind of therapy, I suppose. It's you find things out yourself, and then you move on to the next stage.
Across the river, deep and wide.
The Brothers in Arms album was recorded as far from the madding crowd as imaginable in Beatles producer George Martin's tropical studio on the Caribbean island of Montserrat, a popular place to record then before a volcanic eruption destroyed the island, according to Mark Knopfler.
Used to go down to disco even at the night time, which was, you wouldn't catch me in a disco to save your life.
Just for something to do.
But it was great. It was just great.
What do they play at the disco on Montserrat?
Used to dance and everything. And used to play the local stuff, you know, like Arrow. There's rum down there, a lot of rum. So there's a lot of music and dancing, and then getting into jeeps and going flat out through the back to wherever you were. I remember one night when we were recording, I just got bored, so we would just, I thought it'd be good fun if we timed each other, if we timed each other up the hill to the studio from the road.
In the jeeps?
In the jeeps, in the cars and stuff. So we've got a stopwatch out and we're doing this hill climb, everybody's screeching up the hill. And then Ron and Terry didn't show up. So we eventually went down to look for them, and they'd gone off the road and over the side and been stopped by a couple of trees, and they got out. They were fine.
Oh,
that's an end to that.
So you put out the checkered flag.
Yeah.
Or the caution flag. Okay.
I remember because Alan wanted to go on and better his time. No, let's not. Let's quit while we're ahead.
Oh, jeez.
Still to come, Mark Knopfler and the irony of the mega hit, Money for Nothing. Mark Knopfler performs a two-night homestand in London's Royal Albert Hall tonight and tomorrow. Then Thursday, Mark Knopfler in Asago, Italy, Nice, France on Friday, Salem, Germany Sunday, and then Mark Knopfler goes into June in Zurich, Paris for two nights, Antwerp, Amsterdam, and many more European and Scandinavian shows through July 17th, with a U.S. tour in the fall. You're in the studio with Mark Knopfler. I'm Redbeard for the 5th anniversary of Dire Straits' Brothers in Arms.
Hello, this is Mark Knopfler of Dire Straits in the studio for Brothers in Arms.
Thanks again, Mark. I'm Redbeard on the 5th anniversary of this historic release from Dire Straits, which is a band that Mark Knopfler put to bed in the mid-90s. The irony of the Brothers in Arms story is how the song Money for Nothing, the video for which became the national anthem for MTV, was actually a sardonic swipe inspired by Mark Knopfler's concerns over the music video network.
It was one of the things about MTV that struck me was that it was influencing children seriously. That 9-year-olds were into this.
Big time.
And I saw a little boy in my head, and like a Peter Pan or a graphic, and you're flying across the landscape and you zooming through it and right up into his window. It's like something Steven Spielberg would do. That's how I saw it. At a TV light. You know. And also they were running some ads at the time, I Want My MTV, and you'd see the police or somebody would be on singing Icicle saying, I Want My MTV. So I stole some notes from Don't Stand So Close to Me, for which Sting's publishers demanded 20% or 15% of Money for Nothing. And that's why he gets a co-credit writing, but he didn't actually write it. I just stole 5 notes deliberately from Don't Stand So Close to Me, and just told him that's what I'd done. And he happened to be on holiday in Montserrat at the time I was recording it. So it was perfect. Because at that time, Sting was the perfect MTV creature. So I asked him if he'd come up and sing it, and he was just there like a shot, came straight in and did it, sung beautifully on it.
When did the lawyers get involved? After or up front here?
I don't know. I guess we told them straight away. I told them, I had Ed just call his publishing company and tell them straight away that it was, you know, it was a lift from that dwee dee 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 dee.
But he knew that when he sang it.
I'm sure he did, yeah. I don't know, I would never mentioned it, I guessed. I mean, to me, it was just always implicit that it was perfect.
It's obvious. And it usually doesn't go any further than that. Did that cause any acrimony?
Not at all. I don't care about money, and I don't care about that.
We'll be right back. do it. You play the guitar on the MTV. That ain't working, that's the way you do it. Money for nothing and your chicks for free. Now that ain't working, that's the way you do it. Let me tell you, damn guys ain't dumb. Maybe get a blister on your little finger. Maybe get a blister on your thumb. We got to install microwave ovens, custom kitchen deliveries. We got to move these refrigerators. We got to move these color TVs. The little faggot with the earring and the makeup. Yeah, buddy, that's his own hair. The little faggot got his own jet airplane.
Thank you.
Money for Nothing was the song more than any other that changed the Dire Straits paradigm. It was a number one worldwide single. It was Brothers in Arms' album at number one in the U.S. for 9 weeks straight, eventually becoming the biggest selling album of the 80s in the U.K. Brothers in Arms would win 2 Grammy Awards in early 1986, and 20 years later, Brothers in Arms won another Grammy as the best surround sound album. Rolling Stone magazine ranks Brothers in Arms from Dire Straits at number 347 on their top 500 albums all time. But clearly, rock fans around the globe think that number is soft. Mature, grounded, intelligent, a veteran professional by then with a family support system and long-term loyal friends advising him, Mark Knopfler had as good a chance as anybody of weathering the perfect storm of fame. Things happen so quickly that the tiniest, innocuous debris becomes shrapnel, and the smallest cracks get magnified under tremendous pressure.
Well, I think, yeah, if your personal life is not together, then, you know, and you sort of either running away from it and or whatever you're doing, and I suppose at one point I was, and you're getting on the other side of the world and you can get away from, you let your personal life get away from you for whatever reason, the thing got very big, and with the Straits, it was a great, I've had a great trip with it. You know, I loved it all, but it was... It came coming with a lot of baggage, a lot of stuff, a lot of people, and so on and so forth. And I think I felt that my writing was starting to slip away from, you know, just in some way. I wanted to get back in touch with the guy who sits in a room and writes a song, and you know, maybe records it, and then maybe goes out and plays it for some people, but. To just try and get everything in back to a kind of an optimum size and in perspective, those kind of things will affect you quite a lot. And I suppose when everything else is happening in a big way, but you're not happy, then you're not happy. That will underline that dissatisfaction. That dissatisfaction will be somehow underlined because the success is contradicting it, if you know what I mean. In other words, you're telling yourself, come on, man, you know, you shouldn't be getting down about this. Look at everything else, you know. But having said all that, I'm usually pretty cheerful. I do think that the sense of humor is probably the most important thing that you can have to do this, because you really got to want to do it, you know. So the thing that you would always, that bands always share, nearly always, in my experience anyway, is a sense of humor. You know, that's the kind of that's what you really need to get on through. But I did have a sort of a negative period. Yeah, I mean, back in the 80s sometime, where I was feeling a little bit negative about, you know, the whole thing, and you know, in the end, the love of music, and you know, came back through, and I just got happier personally and personal setup and everything else, and so it just managed to turn it around.
George Harrison and John Fogerty each told me that pop stardom in their early 20s had a surprising downside. Both Harrison and Fogerty felt it had retarded their natural learning arc as guitarists, as pure musicians. Now, you became an international pop star in the mid-80s with Brothers in Arms. Can you empathize with what Harrison and Fogerty felt in that regard?
Yeah, of course. It changes your life. I mean, it actually happened before that. It happened with the first album. You know, back in... you know, around 78 or whenever, and I mean, when you're young, I mean, I was older, thankfully, but when you're a baby, you know, you're really a kid in your teens, it's a heck of a thing just to be able to survive it, let alone anything else. It's an unforgettable experience. I mean, you feel as though you're being unraveled a lot of the time. You know, it's like somebody's got a thread on your sweater and just keeps pulling at it. It's especially for somebody who's interested in looking at the world, and then they're then subject to the world looking at them in a way that they wouldn't look at anybody else in an ordinary sense, you know. The fame, you realize, is like a byproduct of the success, you know. And success is something I'd recommend to anybody. I can't think of anything good about fame particularly. I mean, if you can, let me know.
These mist-covered mountains are home now for me, but my home is the lowlands and always will be. Someday you'll return to your valleys and your farms, and you'll no longer burn to be brothers in arms. Through these fields of destruction, baptisms of fire, I've witnessed your suffering as the battle reached high. And in the fear and the alarm, you did not desert me, my brothers and I.
Thank you.
commemorating the anniversary of Brothers in Arms by Dire Straits. I'm Redbeard. We'll be back in the studio after this. This is Redbeard in the studio, thanking my guest, Mark Knopfler. In the Studio is written and produced by yours truly for Bearded Fish Productions. Copyright 2015, all rights reserved. Transcription by Jane Carpenter Brunet. Theme song by another great guitar player, Andy Timmons. Follow In the Studio on Facebook, at Redbeard Rocks on Twitter, and online at inthestudio.net.